All right, so I'm here with my friend Josh Farkas, and we're going to discuss, or mostly I'm going to listen, he's going to teach me, about a study we've both been waiting for quite some time to come out, the Citrus ALI study. We both have a penchant for the concept of metabolic resuscitation, and that there is more to sepsis than just fluid and antibiotics. So, go ahead, Josh. Our study's just come out. What do you think of it?
This is a really, really interesting study, and I think this presents a statistical quagmire, which honestly I don't think I've ever seen before. So the problem is that the primary endpoint was compromised by two things. So the primary endpoint, for those not familiar with the study, was a SOFA score, and the problem is twofold. First of all, vitamin C caused a pretty dramatic improvement in survival over the first 96 hours that nobody was expecting. And that caused sicker patients to be retained in the vitamin C group, whereas in the control group, they kind of died and they were lost to this primary endpoint. And then the second issue is that vitamin C may have actually caused some patients to improve rapidly and go out of the ICU to the floor. Those patients were also lost to analysis. So the problem is that this essentially introduces a form of survivorship bias, or possibly this might be better termed Niemann bias. And thanks to Marcos Casores for pointing that out on Twitter, which really messes up the primary endpoint and potentially makes it really compromised. So this is a statistical issue that I've honestly never encountered, and I think everyone's going to be arguing about it forever.
That's you know, and I'm going to claim that I can barely get by on statistics and medical literature when I actually see, you know, how high level people do break things down. But that's a crazy, crazy thing. If you lose the patients that actually got the most benefit, and you really skew the population that you're looking at, that's really crazy. And that would call for much more pragmatic trials, you know, that don't have as much inclusion-exclusion, don't you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. And this is something that, you know, is continually challenging, which is that, you know, mortality is a super important endpoint, and there's always this, you know, we always are tempted to want to use mortality as the primary endpoint in studies, but the problem is that you can't, you know, obtain a mortality benefit unless the study is either really, really big or there's a huge effect. So most studies that are powered for mortality end up being negative. So you end up in this quagmire where if you choose mortality as an endpoint, the study generally ends up being negative. But then if you choose kind of some sort of surrogate, you know, endpoint, then sometimes that's really not satisfying either. So it's kind of ironic. I think in this case, the authors, you know, didn't use a mortality benefit because they weren't expecting to see such a big, you know, effect.
Right.
And certainly it's possible that that affects just statistical noise. And then that's led us to this really strange place.
Agree. What do you think about their patient base? I was kind of marked by the fact that they had is it 10 or 15% of oxygen dependent home patients? You know, even at their base selection, which were excluded. But I was like, this is an interesting population. I don't know that I see that much, essentially severe COPD oxygen-dependent patients in my sepsis cohorts. What about you?
I think another fundamental, you know, design issue in the study is that, you know, they performed a pilot study on patients with severe sepsis. And I can't speak for them, but I think they probably wanted to test vitamin C in patients with severe sepsis or septic shock.
Yeah.
But then grant funding came along to look at this in acute lung injury. So they kind of like shifted to a different population, and that shift in kind of caused some problems as far as they were kind of using a pilot study from a different population and trying to extrapolate that onto an ARDS population. And I think that may be responsible for some of the issues as far as endpoints.
Interesting. So I'm going to hop in and put my usual, you know, sour apple on ARDS. And I think it's got a role in this one because, as far as I'm concerned, and we've spoken about this many times, the vast majority of ARDS to me is saltwater overload. on you know, over-enthusiastic resuscitation. And I think I'd be hard-pressed to see a biological mechanism by which if you've overloaded someone, you've got the venous congestion, you've got all that, I don't see how vitamin C is going to bail you out of that. I understand the decreased permeability, but to me that applies if you're using it, you know, relatively early in the course, and it's just, you know, a primary inflammation that's happening. Yeah, I'll believe that maybe you can make it better. But if you flood someone with, you know, your 30 or more mLs per kilos, and they had some pretty good positive balances in there, then I can't see a biological plausibility by which any sort of molecule is going to help you out of that, outside of, you know, Lasix. But even that, you know, we also know that having, once it's been given, you can't just pull it out that way. Any thoughts?
Honestly, you know, these, trying to sort out the biological plausibility with vitamin C is just like incredibly challenging, because it truly has numerous effects on right. the human body. So I think it's really difficult to definitively say, like, yes or no, there's a mechanism for biological plausibility. And I think the other, you know, complicating factor, as you alluded to, is, you know, this is a heterogeneous group of patients. Some of them probably have more volume overload. Some of them have capillary permeability. So we're kind of applying a therapy that has like a very pleiotropic multi-modality effect on a super heterogeneous group of patients. And I think like determining plausibility, it's just so hard.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And what about the biomarkers? Any thoughts on these biomarkers that they selected?
It's, you know, I think one issue is that, you know, the IV vitamin C was used in this study, was applied later than it was in their pilot study.
Right.
So I think that may have caused it to be less effective. It would have been nice to see, you know, changes in the biomarkers. But once again, I think, you know, vitamin C is such a pleomorphic molecule, and I think it's going to be incredibly difficult to know how it's working. So honestly, I think in a complicated situation like this, the clinical endpoints are probably going to be much more useful than the biomarkers. It's possible that vitamin C is doing hemodynamic things, or, you know, who knows what it's doing exactly.
Yeah, we actually had a little bit of a discussion going on this morning on Twitter, and, you know, I kind of, at least philosophically, stated that I don't believe we understand inflammation much, and I don't believe we know that whether something is up or down, whether that's, you know, actually something bad, and therefore that bringing it down is good, or that it's just a marker of something bad, and much like lactate, you know, trying to drive it down might not be an endpoint that is significant. I was just looking at this a few weeks ago, and just, you know, wondering, you know, how many things do we have, you know, in blood? And it turns out that if you dig enough in some of this basic science stuff, you've got like 4,000 plus things floating around in there, of all genres. And what do we look at? Maybe, let's get generous, maybe 50 or 100 things that we look at. And so what about the other, you know, 4,000 that we don't look at? And then we're going to isolate, select a couple of them, even if it's 40 of them, and decide that these are the ones we need to look at? That seems... that seems a dubious way to do it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, I don't know if you've been following this story on checkpoint inhibitors and septic shock, which I think is kind of a crazy thing to do, but there's some folks who actually think that, like, increasing the levels of inflammation could be beneficial. So I think, ultimately, I think it's always best to start with clinical endpoints, and then, you know, these biological markers, maybe they can help us understand what's going on, but they're really difficult to interpret.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think someone was commenting this morning again on Twitter. I think that it is important to try to understand stuff, and totally agree, but I think it has to be done in parallel until we reach the understanding where we actually know what it is, because, you know, I don't know that decreasing some of these things is a good thing. Maybe it's not.
Yeah, totally agree.
So what's... you've been using, fortunate for you, you've been using vitamin C. I still have my hands locked, or my you know, my prescription pen taken away from that.
Yeah.
But does this in any way change your practice? Because here they were using a higher dose than Paul's original study. Does this change anything?
The citrus trial used a much higher dose, which I think makes me feel a bit better as far as safety endpoints go. So sure. If the dose used in citrus was safe, then the dose used in the Merrick trial is probably even safer. I have been using this. I think it's very interesting seeing how it affects practice a little bit. I think in some ways it may, give us more hope that patients are going to do better, and I think that can affect the way that we manage patients, and I think it may have subtle influences on the way that we use fluids. So, for example, I feel like there may be an influence where if we're giving vitamin C, we kind of believe that the patient's going to get better, and we may give less fluid. And I think that there may be some potential self-fulfilling prophecies there, where if we believe that the patient's going to get better, and if we don't think that we need to give them fluid, I think those in and of themselves could be potentially beneficial. So this is really fascinating to me, kind of seeing this play out on the front lines. I think more RCTs will really help demonstrate if this is really helping people, or if it's kind of pushing us into some self-fulfilling prophecies, which affect other therapies for patients which help them. I do think overall our practice has changed and our outcomes are good. It's really complex though.
Yeah, and much in a way that early goal-directed therapy may have ended up saving a lot of lives, maybe not so much because of the actual interventions, but because of the package and the other little intangibles or unmeasured effects that it may have had.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I can say that, maybe I shouldn't say this on air, but I'm just going to say it. Like, before, I started using IV vitamin C, I always felt like, we always want to do the best thing for our patients. We always want to do more for them. So, I'd like reevaluate them a ton of times with ultrasound and see if they were fluid responsive and give them fluid. And then kind of around the time that I started using IV vitamin C, I was kind of like, I think these patients are going to get better. I'm just going to stop doing that. Mm-hmm. And that was around the time that some more evidence was coming out that IV fluid bolsas probably aren't great either. And I think overall I kind of just stopped using a lot of fluid later on, and it's hard to know exactly which one of those factors is beneficial.
That is a really interesting point as well. This study is going to give me a little fuel to charge back at the quote-unquote powers that be to loosen up the reins and allow us to give this potentially beneficial stuff. And it's funny because when you look at those curves, if it was any other study, I feel that if it was any other study that wasn't specifically this whole vitamin C stuff, that, people would be on the other bandwagon and looking at those curves. And certainly if this was an anticoagulant or a cardiology drug of some kind or other, I mean, that curve would have been plastered everywhere and would be on all the billboards or all the medical billboards, so to speak.
Yeah, I think there's something about vitamin C and the way that it was initially, reached the press and the way that it's been publicized. It's ended up being a very emotional and almost political issue. And I think as much as possible, we need to try to avoid that and try to kind of approach this with an open mind, kind of like a judge, just, looking impartially at the evidence and judging it based on its scientific merit. So whether or not you like Paul Merrick or you think he's crazy, the scientific evidence is what the scientific evidence is, and I think we need to challenge ourselves really just to focus on the science.
Yeah, I agree. And I think my take on it, on the global picture, is that it's a, much as it was to me, a year or two ago, it might help, and it sure seems like it does no harm. So in such a, deadly disease, I'd rather give it than not.
I agree with you. I think, in 6 months or, at some point we're going to have an answer. And I'm going to feel terrible about it one way or the other. So if vitamin C, I won't feel terrible, but I'm going to feel bad about it one way or the other. So if vitamin C is proven to be like a magical bullet for sepsis, then I'm going to feel bad that I didn't push it harder. And if it's shown to be ineffective, then I'm going to feel bad that I kind of promoted it gently. So it's like a lose-lose.
Yeah. I agree. But I think, I'd rather be on that side, or I wish I could be on that side, as opposed to the side that says, darn, I really should have been using this. Because in one case, people die. And in the other case, you know, I accept that we're imperfect. We don't know it all. You know, like in 100 years, they'll be like laughing their heads off at what we're doing today, and rightly so, in all likelihood. So that's okay. You know, I think you pointed out this morning or yesterday that, you know, we all do the very best that we know to do on that day, and really not more can be asked, you know?
Yeah, I agree 100%. You know, critical care is constantly in evolution, and I think we need to accept the fact that during our careers, we're going to do things which seemed right at the time, and then more evidence came out, and in retrospect, they were silly. And I think that's just the nature of the beast. If you're going to wait for, like, super A-plus level one evidence for every therapy, then you're going to be way behind the curve.
Yeah, yeah. Not only that, but, you know, at least for those things that have, you know, a very low side effect profile, then, you know, a lot of your patients will have missed out.
Exactly. And I think at any point in time, the best that we can do, and really the only thing we can do, is weigh the benefits, weigh the risks, weigh the costs. And if it seems like the benefits are greater than the risk, then that's a reasonable therapy to do. And over time, all those ratios will change and our practice will change. And that's just the nature of medicine.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for taking some time this morning on our busy days to try and iron this out. Always fun to discuss with you. And
yeah, my pleasure.
Maybe we'll have to do a little metabolic update, especially hopefully, you know, a few more come out before then for H&R20.
Yeah, I think watching this unfold in real time has just been fascinating. In a methodologic level, just seeing all the different studies, and it's really, really interesting. I think there's so much to talk about.
Sounds good. Can't wait for the next time.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
All right, let me just stop this.